during this period, I want to talk about, you know, why Christians should support the modern nation of Israel. And if you get out there, I'm sure, on the campus of Berkeley and everything, in fact, I know they've had at least one riot I read about over this issue, you know, with the Palestinians and everything. But if you were to set up a little table out in the quad somewhere with an Israeli flag on it, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, you didn't get a few physical scars before the day was over. It's a very controversial issue, and most people on the left have almost all adopted the view that somehow Israel's bad and is, you know, taking over these poor ancient Palestinians, you know, land that were founded in 1964. And here we have the British who left their mandate in 1948, and the day after they left, David Ben-Gurion declared Israel to be a state, and so things have begun since then. And we believe that this is leading up to the fulfillment of Bible prophecies. This, you know, may or may not be a specific fulfillment of Bible prophecy, but nevertheless, it's Israel's back in her land, and the stage is being set for the events that will occur after the rapture with the tribulation. And so here you have Israel, the only country or people group in the history of the world that were kicked out of their land. That's a Texas expression. And were scattered around the world and maintained their ethnic identity while outside the land, and then have been brought back into the land. And that's why it's a mess over there today. And so in a book I never finished, but I said, the only legitimate basis for the Jews to claim a right to the land of Israel comes from the Bible. In fact, if it were not for the biblical history of Israel, who would even know to associate the Jewish people with the land of Israel? So a Jewish person cannot escape their biblical roots, no matter how secular they become. It is precisely because God associates the Jewish people with the land that he gave them, located in the Middle East today, that we can even have a movement today known as Zionism. The case for Zionism rises or falls upon what the Bible teaches about Israel and the land of Israel. It is true that just a case for Israel can be presented upon many grounds, but ultimately it boils down to what does God think about this matter as communicated through his inerrant, authoritative word, the Bible. Now, did you know that Jews have lived continuously in the land of Israel for the past 200 years? In fact, most times they've been the majority in the land. Here's a book, if you ever want to look at it, 20 centuries of Jewish life in the Holy Land, and he goes through each generation for the last 20 generations and shows, you know, the extent of Jewish people that have lived in the land of Israel. Mainly Jerusalem, because they didn't do census on the land during the Middle Ages and all of that. So what does the Bible teach about supporting Israel? Well, we start in Genesis 12, 1 through 3 with the Abrahamic covenant, and where he says that I will bless you and make your name great, and so shall you be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. See, plural, I will bless. God wants to bless people. But the one, singular, who goes against Abram and Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and their descendants, he will curse. And this is demonstrated in the early parts of Genesis as he goes into Egypt and even lies, and God curses Pharaoh. He does it again with Abimelech. And, you know, he's in the wrong morally, but God shows that even then, when Israel's morally wrong, God still curses those who curse Israel. And we have our friend in Iran. I can't get a job. I mean, Ahmadinejad or something like that, who for the last few years, every week or so, whether they need to or not, you know, gives some form of a statement about how they're going to wipe the Jews out. You know, this reminds you of Haman in the book of Esther. He was going to wipe the Jews out. And I wouldn't put any money at all, not that I bet, on Persia here, on Iran, because I think God, of course, is going to fulfill his promises to Israel. We see in Genesis 13 where he reiterates this. He tells them to go look at the land, and I will give it to you and to your descendants forever. And here he's talking about the land specifically. And so in Genesis 12:3, records God's promise to bless those who bless Abraham and his descendants, in other words, Israel. The Abrahamic covenant is confirmed to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and his descendants, and is repeated to them, well, 20 times in Genesis. That's, you know, we learned in our inducted Bible study classes, when something's repeated over and over and over again, the author's trying to emphasize something. And that's just in the book of Genesis alone. And although the Abrahamic covenant contains multiple features and stipulation, it always includes the land promises to Israel. One of the most important questions that must be addressed is, does this promise still stand or has it been changed? If these biblical promises are to be taken literally and still apply to Israel and not the church, it should not surprise anyone that such a view leads to Christian Zionism. Now, I believe the Bible teaches two end-time regatherings. First of all, is physical to the land before the tribulation in unbelief, and then spiritual to the Lord at the second coming. So stage one, Ezekiel 36:24, for I will take you from the nations and gather you from all the lands and bring you into your own land. Stage two, spiritual, I will then sprinkle clean water on you, and you will be clean. I will cleanse you from all your filthiness and from all your idols. Moreover, I will give you a new heart and a new spirit within you. And I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes. And you'll be careful to observe my ordinances. In other words, the new covenant will be fulfilled at the beginning of the millennium and on for the nation of Israel. And, of course, this is where Nicodemus, or Jesus, said, are you the rabbi of Israel and do not understand this? You have to be born of water and spirit. Most likely referring to this passage here, that Israel, before it can receive permanent benefit of its calling, has to be cleansed from its sin and given the new birth and the new life. So Israel will be regathered to the land through the before the tribulation and unbelief. They'll be regathered to the land through persecution and for judgment, the wrath of God. And it will be in stages, and Israel's regathering will be sequential and uninterrupted. And that's what we're seeing today. Modern Israel parallels the Israel predicted to exist in the end time. And we see the two regatherings. This is from our chart book where we have these passages listed. Before the tribulation and unbelief, and see the purpose of the 70th week of Daniel, and this is why the pre-trib rapture is important. Only in pre-tribulationalism does the rapture as a separate event from the second coming have significance. Why? Because what does it do? It ends the church age, which is a temporary period in God's plan, so that what? So that God can finish his plan with Israel. He can complete the 70th week of Daniel. And if you have the rapture occurring in conjunction with the second coming, then it doesn't make sense, because it's one gets in the way of the other one, you see. And so Israel is being regathered in unbelief. Why? Because the tribulation period, the time of Jacob's trouble, will be a time in which he will purge out the non-elect, so that all that's left are believing Jews, who will then fulfill the condition for the second coming, which is for the Jews to call on Messiah. Whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be rescued. We'll read the context of that passage in Joel. We have a lot of what I call refrigerator verses. You know, you pull it out and you put it on the refrigerator. There's nothing wrong with doing that as long as you know the context, so that you think about that verse and meditate on it in context of what it's talking about. And so, people, I hear from the pro-Palestinian people within evangelicalism, and it's growing more and more, you know, they criticize Israel because they're not living up to some millennial standard. And this is why it's important to distinguish these two end-time regatherings, because I like to ask a crowd, do you know what one of the conditions is for you to become a believer? You have to be an unbeliever. And I bet everybody in this room used to be an unbeliever before you became a believer. And if the purpose for God is to have Israel go in unbelief through the tribulation so they can become believers, you know, it's not surprising that all but about 15,000 Jews in Israel today are unbelievers. They're being prepared for the tribulation. So don't try to hold them to some standard as if they're believers living in the millennium, you see, and all of these kinds of things. Even though I think Israel and the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, is more humane than probably any other army in the world, nevertheless, this is a purpose. And then you have many, many passages that talk about Israel after Christ returns, where she is regenerate and is sprinkled with clean water and receives the new covenant and goes into the millennium and does fulfill her calling. So Ezekiel 36:24, "For I will take you from the nations and gather you from all the lands and bring you into your own land." So we see in Ezekiel 37 a staged regathering of the dry bones. That's a reference to Israel and dispersion. And by the way, the text says, "These bones are the whole house of Israel." This is not picturing Christian regeneration. This is talking about Israel as a nation being regenerated. So the sinews connected to the bones could be something like the 1948 regathering, or the flesh on the bones could be something like Israel becoming a nation or her present status, and perhaps the skin covering the bones could be something like Israel during the tribulation. In other words, it's a process. I don't think it's intended to identify these specifically, but clearly the breath in the body is Israel after her national conversion, you see. And so we're seeing this process right now. We're at some stage. The modern state of Israel is both still, or modern world Jewry is both still partially in dispersion and partially in the land. So it's a transition phase or period right now. And that's why I think it's in preparation for Christ, for the events of the tribulation. As Dr. Walford used to say, when you're in the mall and you see decorations for Christmas, you know Thanksgiving is near. In other words, the rapture is a signless event, so we can't say that any of this relates to the rapture, but it does relate to preparation for the events that will take place after the rapture. And therefore, the signs indicate that God is getting ready to bring to pass the events of the tribulation period. So that heightens our expectation for the signless event that's going to precede that, the rapture of the church. But Matthew 24 here is an example of those that talk about Israel after the tribulation being regathered. Verse 29 says, "But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from the sky." Quote out of Joel chapter 2. "And the powers of the heavens will be shaken," probably out of Haggai there, "and then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory, and he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other." And so here we see Christ quoting partially Isaiah 11, quoting from Deuteronomy 30, verse 6, about the regathering of the Jews, and also from Daniel chapter 12. And Daniel chapter 12 says that everyone whose name is found written in the book will be saved or delivered. So Christ shortens that circumlocution, everyone whose name is found written in the book, to a single term, the elect. And so this context, as well as the context in Daniel, clearly is talking about Jewish believers who, at the second coming, instead of today Jews, when they go to Israel, fly on LLR Airlines. But here, angels are going to physically bring them back to the Holy Land, or the land of Israel, and this will be a fulfillment of Rosh Hashanah. Don't let anybody try to tell you Rosh Hashanah relates to the rapture or anything like that, because it relates to Israel, not the church. None of Israel's feasts relate to the church. And so we see other passages, 2 Samuel 7:16, "And your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever." Part of the Davidic covenant being given here. And we see God's faithfulness summarized in Psalm 89. He says, "If his sons forsake my law and do not walk in my judgments, if they violate my statutes and do not keep my commandments, then I will remove them as a nation," right? That's replacement theology. No, he says, "I will visit their transgression with the rod and their iniquity with stripes." He's not going to disinherit them. He's going to discipline them. That's what the dispersions are all about. "Nor deal falsely in my but I will not break off my chesed, my loving kindness." The Hebrew word for faithfulness or loyalty, covenant loyalty here. "From him, nor deal falsely in my faithfulness. My covenant I will not violate, nor will I alter the utterance of my lips. Once I have sworn by my holiness," see, God's holiness. You know, as the book of Hebrews says, God can swear by no other name by himself, so he swore by himself. His name, his, there's nothing higher than God. And so he swore by his own name. "I will not lie to David. His descendants shall endure forever, and his throne as the sun before me. It shall be established forever like the moon, and the witness in the sky is faithful." You know, my friend Arnold Fruchtenbaum, back in the 70s, used to give lectures on the college campuses on how to destroy the Jews. He is Jewish, of course, and in fact, Arnold was born in a Russian concentration camp after World War II, after his parents were put there for being Nazi spies. His grandfather, you know, was the top Shas Hasidic rabbi in Warsaw, Poland, who decided for all of Jewry that cucumbers were kosher for Israel. That just shows you what a big dog he was there. And that was his grandfather. You know, tomatoes and cucumbers come from North America, in case you didn't know. And then they went back over there. I guess that's when the Italians started putting tomato paste on their pizzas. But nevertheless, and he barely survived. And when he was 4 or 5 years old, there were back in Warsaw, and the Catholics went on a pogrom against them. And he was hiding under something. He remembers something about 10 Catholic priests carrying a big silver cross saying, "You kill Christ, we'll kill you." And he always says, "My first introduction to Jesus Christ wasn't someone who died for me, but someone I almost had to die for," you know. And so he comes to the United States. He gets saved when he's like 13 years old and all of this kind of stuff. But nevertheless, he used to give a lecture on how to destroy the Jews. And he would go through all these passages about how you can't, you know, he said, always get Arabs and Muslims coming in, you know, and all of this kind of stuff. And, you know, trying to get some real insight. And he would go through all these passages about how you can't destroy the Jews. And then he would go to Jeremiah, where it talks about, if you can destroy the sun, moon, and stars, then you can destroy my people. So he would say, you need to get a rocket and go up and blow up the moon, and then blow up the sun, and then for all these billions of stars, blow them up. And, you know, everybody would leap, go out there going, you know, leaving the lecture and stuff. Probably too controversial to give it today. So, you know, nevertheless, that's how you destroy the Jews. You know, you can't. And so, what? Here you see this phrase "forever" in the land, and we see in Ezekiel 37:25-26, "And they shall live in the land that I gave to Jacob my servant, in which their fathers lived, and they shall live on it, they and their sons' sons forever, and David my servant shall be their prince forever." In other words, Messiah is going to rule in the millennium over the whole world, and David is going to be the vice regent ruling over Israel. Question is, who's going to rule over California, right? And I will make a covenant of peace with them, and it will be an everlasting covenant with them. And I will place them and multiply them and set my sanctuary in their midst forever. So we keep seeing this word forever. I'll talk about it here in a moment. And we see Jeremiah 31. Here's the passage, 35 through 36. Thus says the Lord, who gives the sun for light by day and the fixed order of the moon and the stars for light by night, who stirs up the sea so that its waves roar. The Lord of hosts is his name. If this order departs from me, before me, declares the Lord, then the offspring of Israel also shall cease from being a nation before me forever. And here is the Hebrew word, holam. Well, I'm sorry, I haven't got there yet. Thus says the Lord, if the heavens above can be measured and the foundations of the earth searched out below, then I will cast off Israel from all that they have done, declares the Lord. I don't care how big you are into replacement theology, how do you get around these passages? I mean, God is talking about the very issue of whether or not he's going to replace or disinherit Israel, and he says in very plain language he's not going to do it. I don't care if you look at it Hebrew, Aramaic, English, Chinese, whatever you look at it in, it means the same thing. And they just say that, well, Jesus, this is what people like N.T. Wright say today. They say, well, you know, in the Old Testament, they, you know, were dealing with the land of Israel. And it was that small piece of real estate. And Jesus comes, and because the gospel is going to the whole world, God is no longer just interested in that little piece of real estate over there in Israel, about the size of New Jersey, but he's interested in the whole world. And so we're not earth-centric, we're global-centric in our thing, and they just blow off all of these specific promises by just stating this. We agree the gospel's going to the whole world, but we have passages that say that. How does that nullify the fact that God has made these promises to Israel? You see, I don't see where it does. That's not good enough to just say that now, you know, God's not interested in just one group of people, the Jews. He's now interested in the whole world. And so this is just this philosophical abstractions that they come up with, and they just state them because of their prestige as a scholar. And everybody goes, wow, he's so smart. And he is. He can run circles around you and I intellectually, but he's wrong on this issue. And so Jeremiah 30:11 says, for I am with you, declares the Lord, to save you. For I will destroy completely all the nations where I have scattered you. Only I will not destroy you completely. So that's what we see, a partial destruction of Israel. Here's the Hebrew word olam. And I remember taking a course with Alan Ross at Dallas Seminary called Advanced Hebrew Word Studies. And he spent a whole lecture, you know, class on this word holam, because that's the word that's translated forever or everlasting. But it has the idea of horizon. In other words, as far off into the distance as you can see, thus the horizon. See the idea? And it doesn't come over one-to-one correspondence from the Hebrew to the English meaning forever. It doesn't mean forever in the original Hebrew. But we don't have any other words that translate very well. And so forever in many passages is the closest we have in English, you see. So you have to understand that holam means as long as the earth endures, depending on what it's talking about, or till the end of time. In other words, as far into the future as you can see. So it's talking about something like the land of Israel. Well, we know it's going to be burned up one day, and there's going to be a new heavens and a new earth, you see. So that's not forever in our language, but it means, and that's why I think some of these statements, you know, qualify this by saying as long as the earth endures. And so it has that connotation, and that's why it's translated forever. But here's a term, min olam vad olam. And it means, it's an absolute term in Hebrew, and it means forever and ever. And this term is used a couple of dozen times to describe God. And who would deny that this, as it's used in these passages in the Old Testament, does not describe God who is forever and ever and ever? It does, but there are two times that it's not used of God. And the two instances occur in Jeremiah, where it refers to the land of Israel. He takes this absolute term, so if somebody wants to tell you, oh, Olam doesn't mean forever, because it talks about the Mosaic laws forever, and we know the Mosaic law has been passed away, so they try to use that as a wedge to argue that then the promises to Israel aren't forever. Well, what about these passages? Jeremiah 7:7. Then I will let you dwell in this place, in the land that I gave to your fathers forever and ever. There's the absolute term, you see. Turn, and 25:5 of Jeremiah, turn now everyone from his evil way and from the evil of your deeds, and dwell in the land which the Lord has given to you and your forefathers forever and ever. So these are the absolute statements. And you can't say it any stronger in the original Hebrew. The New Testament follows up with this in Romans 11:28-29. From the standpoint of the gospel, they, talking about Jewish people, are enemies for your sake. But from the standpoint of God's choice, his election, they are beloved for the sake of the fathers. For the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. This is the New Testament where he's talking about the Israel in the context, and the term, the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. A lot of times people, you want to use that for tongues and all of this kind of stuff. But if you do, you're taking it out of context. He's talking about the gifts and calling of Israel are irrevocable. And he's talking here about unbelieving Jewish people, and he says that they are beloved for the sake of the fathers. Who are the fathers? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. These are unbelievers, and yet, soaked down through church history, the church has often treated them as enemies, as if they're people to be hated. This is not even talking about Christian Jewish people. It's talking about unbelievers. Do you treat Jewish unbelievers as people who are beloved by God? Because he does. These are people who do not know Christ as their Savior. And so you wonder sometimes, and this is in the New Testament, and he warns about getting proud and puffed up as the church and treating the Jewish people that way. Exactly a warning against anti-Semitism, which has been a big problem down through church history. Now, having shown you what the Bible, just a quick overview, we could go on for days on the passages in the Old Testament that talk about, I just selected a few about Israel saying, but I want to also show you what does international law teach about supporting Israel, because, you know, you watch TV or you hear some guy come on there and they talk about, you know, how Israel is occupying the land over there illegally, the illegal occupation. You know, I spent 2 weeks in Saudi Arabia about a decade ago, and, you know, they had an English-speaking newspaper there, and, you know, any story relating to Israel, they would have on the thing, occupied Jerusalem, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. Well, of course, I don't know if the Occupy movement has anything to do with all of this, but, you know, most towns or cities are occupied, right? I mean, there's people living here, there's people living there, but we know what they mean. And they'll have some, you know, argument on one of the TV shows or something like that, and they go, occupied Israel, occupied Zionist, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Here's a little video. Tell you what, I'm going to get my microphone ready. Here's a video put out that I think does a good job summarizing a lot of this stuff put out by Israel on this topic.
Terms occupied territories, 67
wars, is this going through the mic?
Illegal settlements.
Okay.
And the story we usually hear sounds very simple. During the Six-Day War, Israel captured the West Bank from the Palestinians, refused the United Nations demand to retreat, and illegally built settlements. But is that really the case? Let's try to understand the situation a little bit better. We'll start with a simple but extremely important question. From whom did Israel capture the West Bank? From the Palestinians? No. In 1967, there was no Arab nation or state by the name of Palestine. Actually, was there ever?
Invented.
Israel took over the West Bank.
Newt Gingrich invented people.
Self-defense. After Jordan joined a war launched by Egypt and Syria to destroy Israel. Oh, by the way, destroying countries is rather illegal. The United Nations back in 1967 rejected repeated Arab and Soviet attempts to declare Israel as the aggressor. Security Council Resolution 242 did not demand a unilateral Israeli withdrawal. Rather, the United Nations called for negotiating a solution which would leave Israel with secure and recognized boundaries. In effect, defensible borders. But wait a second. What was Jordan doing in the West Bank in the first place? What was its legal justification? Well, Jordan had the... You know what? It had no legal justification. Jordan simply occupied it during its previous attempt to destroy the newly established state of Israel in 1948, changing the commonly accepted name Judea and Samaria to the West Bank. But that did not really convince anybody. And almost no one recognized the legality of Jordan's occupation, not even any of the other Arab states. So, if Jordan had no legal claim to the land, and a Palestine did not exist, whose territory is it? Let's go a little further back in time. Don't worry, not to the days of the Bible, only about 100 years. Until 1917, the Ottoman Empire occupied the whole region. After losing in World War I, the Ottomans relinquished their 500-year control to the Allied forces, which decided to divide the old empire into countries. Britain's foreign minister, Lord Balfour, recognized the Jewish people's historical right to their homeland. A small area, equivalent to about half of 1% of the Middle East, was designated for this purpose. Britain received a mandate from the League of Nations to promote the establishment of a Jewish homeland. But wait a second, do you realize what happened? The Jewish homeland originally included not only the West Bank, but also the East Bank of the Jordan River. I guess you cannot say the Jewish people have not accepted some painful compromises already. Anyway, the League of Nations recognition of a Jewish homeland, which includes the West Bank, was reaffirmed by the United Nations after the Second World War. With the British mandate ending, United Nations General Assembly Resolution 181 recommended the establishment of two states, one Jewish and one Arab. The Jews accepted it and went on to create the State of Israel, while the Arabs refused the compromise and launched a war to destroy the newly established Jewish state. Resolution 181, a non-binding recommendation in the first place, remained with no legal standing. At the end of the war, a ceasefire line was formed, where the Israeli and Arab forces stopped fighting. At the insistence of the Arab leaders, this line was defined as having no political significance. So, although this line is commonly referred to as the 1967 border, it is not from 1967, and it was never an international border. This is why a more exact legal definition for the West Bank according to international law is really the same as in so many other areas where there are or were territorial disputes but which are not defined as occupied. For example, Zubara, the Tamz Islands, the Western Sahara, amongst many others. They're not considered occupied territories but rather disputed territories. So, let's return for a moment to our illustration and examine the complete chain of events. Israel's presence in the West Bank is the result of a war of self-defense. The West Bank should not be considered occupied because there was no previous legal sovereign in the area, and therefore, the real definition should be disputed territory. The 1947 partition plan has no current legal standing, while Israel's claim to the land was clearly recognized by the international community during the 20th century. That is why the presence and construction of Israeli settlements in the West Bank should not be considered illegal. These are not just my own opinions. They are based on conclusions made by world-renowned jurists, like Professor Eugene Rostow, Justice Arthur Goldberg, and Stephen Schwebel, who headed the International Court of Justice. So what's the solution for the dispute over the West Bank? Unfortunately, there is no magic solution. But the only way a solution will ever be reached is if we base our negotiations on legal and historical facts. So please, let's stop using the terms occupied territories and 67 borders. They're simply not politically correct.
So, here's a guy named Jacques Paul Gaultier, and he's a Canadian Gentile, and he spent 20 years working on a PhD dissertation on international law at the University of Geneva in Switzerland. And I have a copy of it. It costs $350. It's that thick. It's many. It's 7 or 8, 9 pounds heavy, and you can get your own copy for $350 plus $42 mailing from Canada. And he demonstrated his peer-reviewed work there in international law that Israel has all the rights to the land, but Arabs have civil rights, but no rights to the land. And he has, you know, demonstrated this. Here he is, a non-Jewish lawyer, and has gone through and shown this.
To talk to you about my conclusions after over 20 years of research with regard to the question, who owns Jerusalem in law? I know that the Jewish people, I know that Christians have an answer based on their faith in Scripture.
There's his dissertation.
But come with me into another realm, the realm of international law. And the question is, who has title to this city, this holy city? It took me 20 years to put together these 1,400 pages. Yes.
So we see that another guy named Dr. Harold Grief has also done a similar work called The Legal Foundation and Borders of Israel Under International Law. And he traces the legal history of the land of Israel and the old city of Jerusalem from 1516 up to the year 2001. You can get I bought a copy of this book on Amazon. And Dr. Grief believes that the modern state of Israel has the legal right to the entire land of Israel west of the Jordan River, including Gaza, Judea, and Samaria. And where did they get this legal right? Well, let's follow this story. You had, of course, in World War I, the British who defeated the Ottoman Empire, and they took control of what they call Palestine. And before they captured this, Lord Balfour, who was the Foreign Secretary under Lloyd George, who was the Prime Minister, issued this famous Balfour Declaration, which was a declaration of the foreign policy of Britain, where he said, His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. Now, this was a declaration of British foreign policy. It was not international law. And we see here's Lloyd George. He's the fourth from the left with members of his wartime cabinet in 1916. And what you have, the British being a parliamentary government in a wartime, will have a war cabinet of 9 to 12 people because it's too clumsy to be able to pass everything through parliament, you see. And so they vest a war cabinet of 9 to 12 people with parliamentary power to make decisions. And this is the group that issued the Balfour Declaration. Historians say they would have never gotten it through the British Parliament, but it just so happened that God kind of stacked the deck with people like this. And so here you have the status of the land here, where you had the Ottoman Empire before War One, where it was already divided between the Egyptian side and the Turks, who were vying for control of the Ottoman Empire. And you have, as we said, Lord Balfour, who had been prime minister at one time himself, and he was born in Scotland and reared in a strong Christian home, which instilled into him a love for the Jews based upon a biblical interest. You know, I've read a lot about Balfour, and I don't even know if we'll see him in heaven or not. But nevertheless, he was strongly influenced by his upbringing, you see. And he was a lifelong bachelor, and he was a real playboy. And he served much of his life within the highest offices of British government, including prime minister, as I said. His interest in Jewish restoration was biblical rather than imperial. His sister and biographer said the following: Balfour's interest in the Jews and their history was lifelong. It originated in the Old Testament training of his mother and in his Scottish upbringing. As he grew up, his intellectual admiration and sympathy for certain aspects of Jewish philosophy and culture grew also, and the problem of the Jews in the modern world seemed to him of immense importance. He always talked eagerly on this, and I remember in childhood imbibing from him the idea that the Christian religion and civilization owes to the Judaism an immeasurable debt shamefully ill repaid. In other words, many of the British Christian Zionists had this mentality that the Jews had been mistreated for all these years, and Christendom owed them their land so that they can go there and live in protection. Here's a memorial in Tel Aviv for Balfour, what he did in leading to the founding of the modern state of Israel. There you go. That's the statement that I just read. Here's David Lloyd George, who was the prime minister, and he was from Wales, and he was a big-time Christian Zionist as well. You know, once again, Calvinist luck that they happened to be there together. So David Lloyd George was British Prime Minister, as you can see, from 1916 to 1922 when the Balfour Declaration was issued. Balfour and Lloyd George were both lifelong friends, and he was from Wales, and he was steeped in the Bible in which he was trained as a youth. And this clearly predisposed him to the view with favor of the Zionist movement. And Lloyd George's decision that it was primarily responsible for the British launching a large-scale offensive to conquer all of Palestine despite its risk. In fact, he secretly brought 50,000 troops from the Western Front to the Palestine Campaign, as it was called, and brought his best general, Allenby, over there, who was a Bible-reading Anglican, to ensure that they captured Palestine before the French got to it. Everybody knows the French shouldn't have that. I'm just kidding, of course. And so as a Christian Zionist, he was determined to gain control of Palestine without the French to interfere. He also wanted his country to carry out what he regarded as God's work in Palestine. Lloyd George made a number of statements concerning his biblical upbringing, which influenced him throughout his life. Lloyd George recalled how in his first meeting with Chaim Weizmann who was the father of Zionism? Theodore Herzl. When Herzl died, you know, at an early age, Weizmann took over as head of the Zionist movement. And he was a chemist at the University of Manchester but he was of German descent. So in December 1914, he told Chaim Weizmann, place names kept coming into the conversation that were, quote, more familiar to me than those of the Western Front. Lord Balfour's biographer says that his interest in Zionism stemmed from his boyhood training in the Old Testament under the guidance of his mother. And when speaking about the Balfour Declaration, Lord George said, it was undoubtedly inspired by natural sympathy, admiration, and also by the fact that, as you must remember, we, being a Welshman, had been trained even more in Hebrew history than in the history of our own country. I can tell you all the kings of Israel, but I doubt whether I could even name a half dozen of the kings of England. That's kind of a backhanded slap by a Welshman to the British, to the English, as well as a statement there. Now, what you're seeing is how God providentially put the right people into this administration at the right time, and you have other people like General Smuts and Bonar Law. Andrew Bonar, a very famous Scottish Christian, and who, you know, it's like naming your son John Calvin, whatever, you know, or Charles Wesley, whatever, you know. I mean, he was one of the greatest Scottish Christians, so it's not hard to figure out where this guy's going to land. And so you have these kinds of people, and they voted 7-2 to adopt the Balfour Declaration. And the only two people that voted against it was Lord Curzon, who was an Anglican minister's son, replacement theology guy. And the only other guy that voted against it was the Jewish guy on the thing, because they believed at that time if they created the nation of Israel, then all the Jews would be kicked out of their European countries and they would have to go back to Israel. So many Jews were opposed to the founding of the modern state of Israel. So here's a book called The Origins of Christian Zionism, Lord Shaftesbury and Evangelical Support for a Jewish Homeland. And they make statements like, what seems to be clear is that Christian Zionism appealed most to evangelicals on the margins of British national life. See? And all but two of the guys in this war cabinet were from the margins. In other words, they weren't Englishmen, but they were running the British government. Which makes sense of Christian Zionism attraction to evangelicals situated on Britain's Celtic fringe. That's a reference to the Irish and the Welsh and the Scottish. Especially to Scots and Irish evangelicals that experienced a disproportionate influence in English evangelicalism in the Victorian era. A close examination of the religious and ethnic backgrounds of the men who constituted the war cabinet that issued the Balfour Declaration reveals some notable features. The one member who was firmly anti-Zionist was also the only Jewish cabinet member, Samuel Montagu. And as I've already explained, the only other member was Lord Curzon, the son of an Anglican minister, and he was opposed to the Balfour Declaration. The war cabinet was dominated by non-English members. 6 of the 10 members were of Celtic origin. One was from the South Africa, one from India, and one was German-born, Smuts. And in terms of religious background, 7 of the 9 Gentile members had been raised in evangelical homes or personally embraced evangelicals. In other words, they were actual believers. 6 of these 7 had been raised in evangelical Calvinist homes. See, back then, the Calvinists were the Christian Zionists. Balfour, Scottish, as we saw, Lord George Baptist, Lord Curzon, evangelical Anglican, Andrew Bonar Law, Free Church of Scotland, Presbyterian, Jan Smuts, a Dutch Calvinist, and Edwin Carson, an Irish Presbyterian. And so that is showing you how God at key points puts these people there as he works through Gentile Christians to bring about the founding of the modern state of Israel, interestingly. Here's something you might be interested in, since we're in California. Here is a little-known situation about Richard Nixon, who may not be everybody's favorite president, but this is an interesting situation with him.
Kissinger, turning down Golda Meir's request for arms to defend her country, is reported to have said, "Let the Israelis bleed a little." Golda Meir is desperate. Without help, Israel will not survive many more days of the pounding assault.
Yom Kippur War.
Despite all the Kahalanis and those like him who are bravely defending their homeland. And
Ariel Sharon there.
Lives on all the front lines. And so she picks up the phone and calls the private line of U.S. President Richard Nixon. It is 3 o'clock in the morning.
There's a 3 a.m. call.
Television film producer and documentarian Bill McKay's investigation of the American role in the Yom Kippur War describes what happened when President Nixon took Golda Meir's call in the middle of the night.
"Mr. President, if you don't help us, the Jewish people will never survive." He said something interesting, if not strange. He said, "You know, I could almost hear my mother's voice. She would tell me stories and read to me from the Old Testament, the heroes of the Bible. And one afternoon she said, 'Richard, someday you're going to be in a position where you can help save the Jewish people. And when that day comes, you must do everything in your power And he said, at that moment, I realized, maybe for the first time in my presidency, why I had become president of the United States.
It was the largest airlift of armaments since World War II. The president kept his word. Everything Golda asked for, she got. Every weapon, every vehicle, every piece of equipment, and all the ammunition to operate them. A virtual arsenal airlifted overnight to Israel's front lines.
Many military experts credit that decision, that request, at that moment, as the essential element that saved Israel from destruction.
In another striking parallel to David in the Bible, Richard Nixon turned aside the Goliath of indifference to Israel and his government, faced down a powerful Secretary of State who would turn against him, and accepted the threat to his own presidency to save Israel in its hour of need. Before it was over, the Yom Kippur War demonstrated one of the most incredible turnaround victories ever recorded in military history.
So, you see that God uses Gentiles to reestablish and, in this case, save the nation of Israel. And most of them have some kind of biblical influence in their youth. Of course, people are losing that. We see here the British Mandate, 1920, the maps that they were talking about in the video. And this was the area allocated for Jewish National Home in San Remo Conference in 1920. And so these are the maps as they were divided. This was even as late as 1946, was supposed to be Israel or Palestine, and then the partition plan in 1947, which was really illegal. And so what you have at the end of World War I is the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 to distribute the captured land in the breakup of the Ottoman Empire. And you had the representatives, I think, from Britain, France, Japan was there. The United States was not in this group and not part of this. And so the Arabs and the Jews presented their claims together. Faisal and Chaim Weizmann had gotten together and agreed that Israel should get Israel. The leader of the Arab world, Faisal, at that time from Saudi Arabia, agreed with that. And part of the reason he did is because he had gotten his sons, one as ruler in Iraq, one as ruler in Jordan, and one, they're there, and he was kind of embarrassed that he was kind of taking over all the Ottoman Empire, and so he thought it would be a concession to give the Jews, you know, the land of Israel. So they both supported their claims, and there's he is, Faisal, with his three sons there, and they weren't able at the Paris Peace Conference to finish distributing the land, so they said, by the time it ended, so they said that we will have another conference later and decide these issues. And so there's the official treaty of peace that on January 19th, the Arabs and Jews would support each other. And on April 19th, the Arabs and the Jews presented their territorial claims. They weren't able to be decided until later. And in June 18th, 1919, Article 22, temporary mandatory powers until the people could develop, was given to Britain. Until they receive their full mandate. And what happened at San Remo is they took the language of the Balfour Declaration and they incorporated it into the League of Nations and the mandate that gave Britain the right over not just Palestine but over Iraq, Jordan, and these other places. And that then, the Balfour Declaration then becomes international law. And it basically said that, see this language, the best method of giving practical effect to this principle is that the tutelage of such people should be entrusted to an advanced nation who by reason of their resources, their experience, or their geographical position can best undertake their responsibility and who are willing to accept it, that this tutelage should be exercised by them as mandatories on behalf of the League. In other words, the League of Nations, which was later became the United Nations. And everything the League of Nations did was carried over into the United Nations with the force of law. And so the French, for example, were given a mandate over Syria and Lebanon. And so they were to take these nations and provide tutelage until time when these could become independent nations. And this is why you see Mesopotamia became Iraq in the 1930s. Jordan gained its independence in the 1930s. Syria and Lebanon gained their independence, you see, in the 1930s. And this was supposed to be what was to happen to Israel. The British were supposed to oversee, after World War I, them becoming a nation. And the San Remo Conference in April of 1920 is where they decided this as an appendage to the Paris Peace Conference and gave it international law. And what happened is, I don't know what happened, but nevertheless, something happened. We're researching this, that they didn't do this. Part of what happened was, after Lloyd George's administration left in 1922, the British had received hostile administrations that did everything they could to undermine giving this to Israel. And I think the British themselves reneged on fulfilling this. My point is, based on international law that was then adopted by the United Nations, Israel has the legal right to the land. And this is what all of these researchers are showing. And we've forgotten, the international community has forgotten a lot of this. And so they have passed all of this other kind of stuff. So what I'm saying, in essence, is, to make a long story short, is that God has given Israel the land, and that's the real issue. It really doesn't matter anything else. But as you get involved in these discussions, it's also good to know that Israel is not coming in and stealing land and taking over things that, from the international basis, is not theirs. They are simply trying to claim, or at least certain people, there are many Jews in Israel who are opposed to Israel. 15 to 20% of them, you know, because modern Israel was formed on two basic principles. It was a Zionist nation. It was to favor the return of Jews to be their national homeland, and it was set up as a democracy, and those conflict at times. And so you have the left-wingers in Israel, they're called post-Zionists, who believe that democracy should trump Zionism, and then you have others who believe that Zionism should trump democracy, these kinds of things that you have going on even in the nation of Israel. And so when these people get on television and everything and claim that Israel has stolen land and all this kind of stuff, it's just not true based on international law. But God is working this out, and because humans, fallen, sinful human beings are involved, it's a messy situation over there that God is going to resolve. And who knows, we may see a war in the Middle East here in the next few weeks or months. Let's pray. Father, thank you that you're going to keep your promises. You're in the process of working even in the hearts of fallen, sinful man to bring your promises about in history. And we see you at work, and we realize that everybody involved is not some saintly believer involved in this, but nevertheless, just like you worked through Cyrus and others, so you're working through failed presidents in the United States to maintain a national presence for your people in anticipation of your plan going forward. And we thank you for this. In Christ's name, amen.